Yes.
Jeff says smile. Don't look so grim.
Grim topic.
Live from Washington, it's the Inside Scoop, with all the news the government does not want you to know. Now here's the host of the Inside Scoop, Congressional Attorney Mark Levin.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Imagine you lived in Laredo, Texas, kind of a dusty little town, not a town that most Americans have even heard of. If they do know about it, they know that it's next to the Rio Grande, next to the Mexican border. Anyway, imagine that you live in Laredo, Texas, and there's an election in Mexico. Now, the Mexican government has had corrupt presidents for years and years, and that actually is true. There is a lot of corruption in Mexico. So they have an election, and 44% of the people vote for an anti-American government. Now, they may be voting for the government to get rid of the corrupt current Mexican government. But in any case, they vote for a government that's anti-American, that's dedicated to what they call the destruction of the imperialist American regime. And they start shooting missiles into your city. Now, your city's Laredo. It's a poor, dusty city. Sorry if you're from Laredo. I assume it's dusty. I may be wrong. But the missiles come, and one of them hits your child's school, and one falls in the courtyard of a hospital, and another one hits your neighbor's home. And they keep coming, more and more and more, until you have 40 missiles a day. 40 missiles a day. That's 2 missiles an hour. Every half hour, you or your child might be hit, or one of your relatives across town. Every half hour, an explosion. You appeal to your government, the United States of America, but they do nothing. They condemn the attacks. They urge people to stop the attacks. They try to negotiate to prevent people from attacking. Nothing seems to work. And to be clear, obviously I'm not really talking about America. I certainly believe that whether any of the three senators running for president wins, Senator McCain, Senator Obama, or Senator Clinton, all three of them would not just sit there and allow an American city to be bombed by missiles. Our troops wouldn't allow that. Our government wouldn't. So let's say you're living not in Laredo, Texas, but in Washington, D.C., or in Fairfax, Virginia, or in New York City, and you don't really know anybody in Laredo, but they do keep getting hit. And then suddenly, things change. Suddenly, they go from Laredo to San Diego, California, a major American city sitting near the Mexican border, and they start shooting more accurate missiles there. And they start killing more people. A 10-year-old boy is killed, a baby girl. What do you do then? What do you do if the entire world tells you to do nothing? What do you do if the entire world says, let your citizens die? It's better to let your citizens die rather than attack. What do you do? It's a tough situation. Obviously, this is a situation that has been confronting the Israeli government over many, many years, ever since Hamas took over in Gaza. Finally, Israel, this weekend, exercised its right of self-defense. Now, every nation under international law has a right of self-defense. If you look, we can see right here the United Nations Charter. Here we have it, Article 51. This is what the last article in the Charter, and it says, nothing in the present Charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations. In Israel's case, of course, there was an armed attack. They continued to occur, and, well, Israel finally took self-defense. And in doing so, they tried very hard to kill the terrorists. They didn't kill them all. According to the Israeli army, they killed about 100 people in Gaza. 90 of them were terrorists. 90 of them were setting up missiles, trying to shoot Israeli citizens. 10 of them were civilians. So I have another thought experiment for you. Imagine that you're a civilian and you're in a refugee camp. And you're in a small refugee camp. You were put there. Maybe you were born when Egypt rounded you up and put you in the refugee camps. A lot of people don't realize that all the refugee camps in Gaza were built by the Egyptian government between 1948 and 1967. So the Egyptian government puts you in a refugee camp, refuses to allow you to become a citizen of Egypt, and you live there in squalor. And then between 49 and 67, the Egyptians attack Israel. Israel responds and conquers the land. And now you're under Israeli occupation for another 30 years, 40 years. And conditions are tough. They're not good in Gaza. They're not good at all. Yeah, Israel builds some hospitals and some universities that you never had. But you want to rule yourself. You want to have your own people rule over you. And the people that are ruling over you, the Palestinian Authority, they're corrupt. They They take a lot of money, they put it in Swiss bank accounts, they really don't care much about you. So, there's an election, and you vote for change, maybe. You vote for Hamas. Yeah, you know Hamas is dedicated to the destruction of Israel, your neighboring state, and you know that Israel would probably respond, but you think Hamas, maybe they don't really mean it. Maybe they won't really attack. Maybe they'll just be something different than the corrupt Palestinian Authority. And so Hamas takes over. And they use your own home as a missile launching site. And you tell them to go away. You know what's going to happen. They're going to launch missiles from your front yard. Israel's going to respond. And your kids are going to get hurt. What do you do? What do you do? It's hard to fight Hamas alone. You can't march in the streets. You can't have a protest. Hamas is a dictatorship now. After winning the election, they closed off dissent. They closed all alternative parties. They monitor the press. They are a totalitarian dictatorship. What do you do? One Palestinian woman chased Hamas out of her yard repeatedly again and again, but they liked it because it had trees. Trees to go undercover to launch their missiles into Israeli cities. Finally, Israel responded, and unfortunately, the woman was out there, and she died. Her son did, I guess, what is the right thing under these circumstances. He chopped down his own orchard. It was the only way to prevent Hamas from setting up a missile shop in his backyard. There are no easy answers in Israel. If you are an Israeli citizen, if you're the Israeli government, you can't have your citizens being bombarded by missiles day in and day out. No country would stand for it. No country has stood for it. If you're a Palestinian, if you're Hamas, it's easy. Stop sending the missiles. But if you're an ordinary Palestinian citizen, you have no easy answers either. Except, I guess, join together and have a revolution. The irony is that if Israel were to reoccupy Gaza, which they started to do last weekend, and we'll talk about that, Palestinians would be better off. It's counterintuitive. You would think Israel leaving occupation would be a good thing for Palestinians, but it's not. Palestinians did better. They had better economic security. They had better physical security when they weren't ruled by a totalitarian government. Yes, Israel had checkpoints. People had to be checked, just like when you go on an airplane and they check you, and that's not good. But that's because the terrorists keep functioning there. What are the solutions in the Middle East? What would you do if you were the Israeli government? What would you do if you were a Palestinian citizen? What would you do if you were an Israeli citizen? A country has a right to self-defense, absolutely. But what do you do when terrorists have taken over your very country and are using it to kill other innocent people? Whose side are you on? Let me just say that throughout this hour, I want to encourage folks to call in. You may agree or disagree with my analogies. You may agree or disagree with how I present things. That's okay. Call in. Let me know what you think. The number's on your screen, 571-749-1166, or toll-free if you're listening on the web, 888-488-MARK. This hour, I want to go through the history of the region, what's going on, and what possible solutions can there be to ongoing violence. And I want to emphasize the difficulty, I guess, of everyone concerned, and also make clear who the real enemy is. The real enemy is anyone, any country on earth, that intentionally attacks innocent civilians. That is wrong, and it should be called wrong. And I must say I am surprised. No, I'm not. I wish I were surprised. It's sad, let's just say, how little of the world ever condemned these attacks when they happened. Every single day, 40 missiles a day raining on Israel, and a few people say this is bad. Senator Obama, to his credit, does send a letter to our United Nations ambassador telling him the Security Council should not take any action against Israel until it condemns and stops Hamas from shooting those missiles in. He understands the right of self-defense. I don't think McCain and Clinton are any different. But what does the world do? What does Europe do? European countries have this strange idea that they are allowed to have self-defense, that the United States of America is allowed to have self-defense. After all, after September 11th, there were signs in the French press, we were all Americans now. Everyone seemed to understand that when terrorists came to our nation and murdered 3,000 innocent people, that we had a right to self-defense. Virtually no one in the world criticized us going in and occupying Afghanistan in self-defense. Now, to be clear, the war in Iraq was very different from that, right? I mean, the war in Iraq, Iraqis didn't attack us. That's a very different thing. But the right of self-defense is very well understood in international law. And it seems to apply to every nation on earth, according to the United Nations Charter, except Israel. There are those that argue, yes, actually argue, that Israel, unique among nations, has no right to self-defense. That it must allow its citizens to die and can't do anything about it. And I would ask those of you that have said in recent times, have complained about what Israel did this weekend, where they went in and yes, they killed 90 terrorists, and yes, they killed 10 civilians. And I don't think anyone would argue, no one in their rational mind could argue that Israel didn't try very, very carefully to avoid killing civilians. I would hope, frankly, that we in Iraq could do that kind of good, 90%, right? That we wouldn't kill as many civilians at a lesser rate. Unfortunately, it appears that hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians have been killed, not necessarily all by us, most by the civil war that's going on there. But war is hell. And in wartime, civilians are killed. And so let me be clear that I urge Israel to act in the most responsible manner and do everything they can to minimize civilian casualties. But at the same time, I think those that would say that Israel has no right to respond not only don't understand international law, they may not even realize what they're saying. What they're saying, some of them, is that every country on earth can defend itself except for Israel. And I've heard people, I've had people call into the show, and I hope some of you will call into this show, even if you disagree with me, or if you agree with me. But I've heard people call in and say, you know, it's terrible, Israel's occupying Gaza. Israel is trying not to occupy Gaza. Israel, of course, didn't occupy Gaza from 1949 to 1967 when it was under Egyptian control and when constant terrorist attacks were coming from Gaza. Israel left Gaza in 2005, unilaterally. They couldn't get a peace deal. So they left. And Palestinians came in, they burned down the synagogues, and they took over the Jewish settlements there. And okay, maybe you don't like the settlements, they're gone, they left. And this was their chance. This was the chance of the Palestinian Arabs to create their own state, to live in peace. And instead the missiles kept coming. There was even a truce between Hamas and Israel. Israel obeyed the truce. Hamas did not. What are the answers? Israel's in a tough bind. The Palestinian Arabs are in a tough bind. What do you think the answer should be? Toll-free number, 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back after this.
How far would you go to help someone? Would you go to the end of your driveway? Would you cross a street? Would you cross an ocean? To a place 6,000 miles from home? And how long would you go? Would you go for a week? A month? A year? Would you go for 2 years? Would you go if you could use your knowledge to teach someone, and in the process, maybe learn something yourself? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps.
Jay, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important piece of equipment. I also wear another helmet that's just as important. A bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
Monica and her friends want you to know that you should never get near a dog when it is eating, playing with a favorite toy, or sleeping. It's really important to make time for exercise and games and keep your dog's vaccines up to date. Never leave a dog in a small, confined space. This can make dogs aggressive like Monica. If you follow this advice, you and your dog can play safely and happily together.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I do want to encourage folks to call in, whether they agree or disagree with me. The number's on your screen, 571-749-1166. Some of you like to write into the show. Maybe you don't want to call. You'd rather express your thoughts in writing. That's okay, too. Just go to radioinsidescoop.com, post your comment right there on the blog, and I can read your comments right here on the air. During the break, it was pointed out, what are the roles of Arab leaders in this regard? And it's a very interesting thing. One may ask, for example, why Hamas is doing what it's doing. After all it's achieving for Palestinians is misery. They've gone from a bad situation to a far, far worse situation. Well, Hamas's goal is clear. Hamas wants power. Hamas wants to take over the West Bank. Hamas wants its own people to suffer. Because the more they suffer, the more Hamas believes they will turn to radical terrorists like Hamas. And then they'll be able to get rid of the relatively moderate Palestinian Authority that's controlling the West Bank. So their goal is to make the situation worse. And yet, there's a secret weapon that the Palestinians have, one they've never tried, one that belongs to them as clear as I think is possible. It's a weapon that would destroy any idea of Israeli control in the territories. It's an idea that would immediately lead, very shortly, to a full, peaceful Palestinian state. What's their secret weapon? Is it one of those missiles or one of those new missiles from Iran? No, their secret weapon is nonviolence. If the Palestinians just once would read the words of Martin Luther King or of Mahatma Gandhi and would just once try to march without throwing rocks, without shooting at soldiers, simply march in the streets and decry violence of all kinds. Decry Israeli violence, decry Hamas violence. Ask Hamas, get your missiles out of our gardens. I think they would see immediately a great response by the Israeli people. Israel, of course, is a democracy. Hamas was elected but no longer allows democratic principles in Gaza. And Israel would love to give up most 2/3 or so of Israelis support a two-state solution. All Israel wants is the idea that their children can go to sleep at night without being attacked by missiles. So why don't they try it? Why don't they try nonviolence? I mean, it's worked in so many other categories. What is it about the Palestinian leaders, at least, that won't let them try nonviolence? Part of it, I think, is the fact that, well, there's so many dictatorships in the region. There are Muslim democracies, don't get me wrong. Turkey is a very strong, secular Muslim democracy. Indonesia is coming along, being a very good democracy. But in the Arab world, it's all dictatorships. In Egypt, in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, it's all dictatorships. They all persecute their own people. And the leaders understand, as every dictator understands, that one of the best ways to stay in power is to change the focus from what's going on in your country to what's going on somewhere else. See, one of the things that they do in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt is if they focus attention on Israel, then nobody focuses on how bad those governments are. Egypt, for example, is terrible about human rights. Egypt mistreats its own people. Egypt is a terrible dictatorship, one, admittedly, that we support. But if they can just turn people's attention to an enemy, to Israel, then they won't focus on their own government. And I think that's one of the main reasons why the Arab leaders want to have this kind of attack. Let's see. We've got Vanessa from Reston. Vanessa, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes.
And I just want to say that I support what you're saying.
Thank you.
I don't know much, but I know that something is wrong when Israel really, really trying to make peace. And when Israel is only trying to protect their families, their children, their land, and I just think that it's, you know, it's just kind of crazy, and I don't understand why the Palestinians are still fighting. I really, really don't.
Well, Vanessa, let me ask you this. Why do you think that Israel, sort of unique among the world's countries, is told by, say, Europeans, you know, don't fight back, take the missiles, but don't fight back?
Because they are afraid, and they want to appease people who are throwing a tantrum, and people who are not being fair, and people who are not being reasonable. And maybe something is not working right in their heads.
Well, let me ask you this on the other side. What do you think the Palestinians should do? Let's say you have a Palestinian that really wants peace, but they're ruled by Hamas. And Hamas is, like I say, sticking missiles in their yard, and they won't go away. What do you think a Palestinian should do who wants peace? Because it's difficult for everybody concerned, but they have, you know, their government is putting missiles in their yard.
I know it's tough.
It's tough.
I feel bad for them too, and I know it's not everybody. But you have to be brave, and sometimes you have to sacrifice and give your life for what is right. You have to stand up sometimes, and I mean they can't kill everybody.
Right. Well, I appreciate your call, Vanessa. I think I would hope that the world would support reinstalling the more moderate Palestinian Authority in Gaza. The Palestinian Authority controls the West Bank. They're certainly no fans of Israel. They certainly want to have a state of their own, but they believe at least that shooting missiles doesn't solve anything, and that the best way to work things out is at the peace table. And I should say that I think Mahmoud Abbas, who runs the Palestinian Authority, is a man that I think can, I don't know how powerful he is, I'm worried about that, but I think he's trying. He, of course, withdrew from the peace talks because of pressure, but I think he's willing to come back. And the thing is that if Mahmoud Abbas can, and Israel may have to, you know, reinvade to put him back in power, but I hope if he gets back in power, what that could do is that could take the people in Gaza who want peace, and they together they can get rid of the bad elements in their midst. I'm just concerned that where Hamas is concerned, it's sort of a lose-lose situation. They are trying to rile up people. They're trying to make people mad. It's interesting. I was reading about the most recent truce in Israel. There have been several of them. In 05, when Hamas first took over, there was a truce, and Hamas broke it within 2 hours. There was another truce in 06. Israel came back, reoccupied Gaza, left again, and again they broke the truce. But you have to understand what Hamas wants. They don't want a truce. They don't want peace. They don't want a two-state solution. They want one state. They want to have no Jewish state in the region. They want to have only Arab states in the region. That's part of their program. And so it's not about trying to find a fair solution for two peoples. It's about destroying the state of Israel. Vanessa, do you have a last comment? Go ahead.
I agree, and I see that it's very childish. It's not humane. It's not showing brotherly love. You know, we all have conflict, but you can solve it in a better way besides killing people. You don't always have to kill someone to get what you want. You can compromise. You can strategize. You could come and talk. You don't have to kill women, children, but you have to protect yourself. If someone is trying to hurt you, you have no choice.
Well, thank you, Vanessa. I really do appreciate your call. If someone else wants to call in with the same view or a different view, I do want to encourage you to do that. The number's on your screen, 571-749-1166. I want to explore some of the Western reaction to this, some of the reaction in Europe, some of the reaction in the United States. The Methodist Church in the United States, generally a very liberal, tolerant church, is considering a resolution to divest from Israel. It's really kind of a surprising thing. I mean, here you have Darfur, you have genocide going on with the Sudanese government. You have in Burma and in Saudi Arabia and in Liberia. I mean, I can name country after country where terrible things are happening to minorities, to women. Darfur is the most serious. You have genocide going on there. And you don't see the Methodist Church trying to divest from those businesses. In fact, they actually invest in Halliburton, which is clearly not doing a very good job with protecting civilians in Iraq. So what is it about the Methodist Church? What is it about, say, the European powers that makes them uniquely focus on Israel? What is it about these groups? For example, European nations, nations that firmly believe in the right of self-defense for themselves, but don't believe in it for Israel. Now, some of it, no doubt, has to do with sympathy for the Palestinian people, for the Palestinian Arabs in Gaza, who 44% of them made a bad choice. 44% of them 3 years ago voted for Hamas. But that, because 44% of them did that, shouldn't mean that they have to suffer a death sentence for the rest of their lives. Israel has to respond, yes, but they should be able to have another election. I think that they're already recognizing that it's not a good choice. In fact, there was an interesting article in the Washington Post recently where a number of people in Gaza were talking, and they were looking over their shoulders, wanted to see if there was a Hamas minder, before they told the reporter that Hamas had really ruined Gaza. I think, unfortunately, what's going to happen is Israel's going to have to reoccupy Gaza. It's not the best solution. Israel has said it doesn't want to do that. But if, as I expect, Hamas keeps shooting missiles, keeps trying to kill Israeli citizens, the best solution, I think, for both Israeli citizens and even more so for Palestinian Arab citizens is for Israel to come back in and to get rid of the terrorist groups. If you want to call in, please do so. We'll be right back after this.
Serves a sentence with you.
I'm Bob Costas, and I've been broadcasting sports for a long time. Much of what I do is ad-libbed, but still, one of the most important aspects of my job is being able to write. Narrations, essays, commentaries. It's essential to express those thoughts and concepts clearly and concisely. Good writing is essential for almost any career. And with today's advanced technology, the National Commission on Writing reports that the need to write well has never been more important. Writing is everybody's business.
Sure, my neighbors Gene and Louise, they may be superheroes with superpowers, but that doesn't make them so super at saving energy and money.
Honey!
I may not be able to harness the power of the elements, but I save significant cash and help the environment with appliances, electronics, and windows featuring the Energy Star label. So discover your own energy-saving superpowers. Go to ase.org/consumers.
Mom, Dad's making fun of you again.
We're back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
We often hear that the war in the Middle East is going on and on forever. And I think at the heart of it is that you have people with real grievances. And also, you have people that are encouraged to have grievances. And there is a difference. obviously, there are Palestinians in refugee camps. And some of these refugee camps are miserable, particularly in Gaza. And part of it, I think you have to go back and understand how this situation happened. There are many, many times in world history where you have a land that's inhabited by two peoples, and it separates one to another. For example, Pakistan and India were all part of the British Empire. And in 1949, you had one large British India, and you had Hindus and Muslims, and they were living together. But the Hindus didn't want to be ruled by the Muslims, and the Muslims didn't want to be ruled by the Hindus. So when Britain left the area, there was fighting between them. And a line was drawn. And the Hindus were basically in the center part of India. That country became India. And the Muslims on the west became Pakistan, and on the east of India became Bangladesh, or East Pakistan. A lot of people don't know what happened at that point. At that point, tens of millions of people crossed the international boundaries. You see, there were tens of millions of Hindus who were in Pakistan and Bangladesh and didn't want to be ruled by Muslims. And there were tens of millions of Muslims that were living in India and didn't want to be ruled by Hindus. And so these refugees left their countries, and Pakistan and Bangladesh took in tens of millions of Muslims. India took in tens of millions of Hindus. And there's still problems between India and Pakistan. Of course there are. I don't want to say that they're not. But at least there are not refugees. The people there have homes. The same situation happened in 1948. In 1948, as you may know, throughout the 40s, Jews were kicked out of Arab countries. In fact, there were 800,000 Jews that were kicked out of Arab countries, native to the Middle East. In fact, the Jewish community of Iraq dates back in the Bible. You can read about the Babylonian exile. It dates back about 2,500 years. The Jewish communities in Egypt and Syria were very old, and they were forced to leave those countries. And they came to Israel and they found a home, along with the Jews who were, let's face it, murdered in Europe, also found a home in the state of Israel. In the Arabs that were living there, many of them left as well. Now, there's some argument about that. Certainly, the Arab League encouraged them to leave. You had, for example, the head of the Arab League talk about a great war of extermination, and they wanted everyone out of the way so they could just kill everyone in sight. Some, no question, left because of fear, because they didn't want to live under a Jewish state. The ones that stayed, they became Israeli citizens. And in fact, of course, the Arabs of Israel have equal rights today. But those that left were not allowed to become citizens of the countries that they left. You may know that in 1947, the land of the British Mandate of Palestine was split by the world into a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews accepted the Jewish state. The Arabs did not accept the Arab state. Egypt came and invaded and took over the southern part of the Arab state. Transjordan, which was trained by the British, came in and took over what became the West Bank. So there was no Arab state of Palestine because Egypt took over Gaza and Jordan took over the West Bank. But here's the surprising thing. Instead of taking the refugees into their countries and making them part of their own, as India took over the Pakistani Hindus and Pakistan took the Indian Muslims and Israel took the Arab Jews, the Arab countries refused to accept the Palestinian Arabs as citizens. They could not become citizens of any country. Today, only Jordan allows Palestinians to become citizens. And even their children can't become citizens. Even their grandchildren can't become citizens. It's an interesting thing that Arabs uniquely discriminate against Palestinians in a way they don't discriminate against anyone else. Why? Why do Arabs uniquely hate Palestinians? Is there something about Palestinian Arabs that Egyptians hate and Syrians hate and Lebanese hate and Saudis hate? I don't think so. I think they want Palestinian Arabs to be miserable because that leaves more pressure against Israel. And then they fight against Israel. And then, again, they don't focus on the dictatorships and the misery in many of these Arab countries. So it's all very purposeful. The Palestinian Arabs, unfortunately, are pawns in a larger game. One as much caused by the Arab League as it is by the state of Israel. There is a caller who wanted to write the questions down and have it take it off the air. And asked if I think that Hezbollah will try to open another front from Lebanon to ease the pressure on Hamas. Ooh boy, that's a tough question and a very hard one. As you may know, when Hamas kidnapped an Israeli soldier and took him, and Israel responded into Gaza, you had Hezbollah also attack in the northern front, and they have much more deadly missiles, and they were hitting Israel's third largest city, Haifa. It would be as if missiles landed not in Laredo, but in Chicago. Imagine Chicago being under regular attack. And Israel came in to fight them back. And what's interesting again is the world reaction. The world condemned not Hezbollah for attacking Israel's third largest city of Haifa and trying to kill civilians there. The world condemned Israel for fighting back fiercely. It's a very strange thing. And so what happened? The Security Council met and they passed a resolution. And the resolution said, Israel, you have to stop fighting. And in return, we, the world community, we, the Security Council, promise to disarm Hezbollah. And it's a Security Council resolution that requires peacekeeping forces from the United Nations to come in there and disarm Hezbollah. And the Lebanese government is required to disarm Hezbollah. And is Hezbollah disarmed? No. No, the world didn't keep their promise. Hezbollah now has as many arms as they ever had before. So why is it that the world never wants Israel to fight in self-defense, but at the same time allows Israel's enemies to arm themselves? Think about that. I have to say that I don't think that's because of America. I actually think that America, whether Republicans or Democrats, 90-95% of Congress, 90-95% of Americans understand the right of self-defense. They feel bad for Israel. Many believe there should be a two-state solution, but many understand the right of self-defense. No, I think the problem is in Europe, largely in Europe. I mean, there are dictators all over the world that can do whatever they want. But I think in Europe, you have countries that very much depend on Arab oil, and also countries that perhaps feel bad about their own role in the Jewish Holocaust. And if they can just blame the Jews for problems, then maybe they feel a bit better about what they did. In any case, Hezbollah is rearmed. And the question is, do I think Hezbollah will try to open another front? I certainly hope not. But if they do, I think Israel has to fight back and fight back hard. And I guess I have to say the world be damned. Now, that doesn't mean they have full right to go after civilians. They should go after military targets. But what do you do? This is a really difficult moral and philosophical question. What do you do when someone shoots at you and holds a child in front of them? What do you do when a terrorist tries to kill you and puts a civilian in front of them? That's how these people fight. And it's a very difficult situation. It's kind of, I've argued, it's kind of like if a guy breaks into your home and starts killing your children and wearing almost like a bulletproof vest is his own child, one on the front and one on the back. And you can shoot him, and you can kill him, and you can stop him from killing your kids, but to do so, you have to kill his own kids. What's the answer? What's the moral answer? International law, as shown by United Nations, Charter 51, international law says that, yes, you have a right to self-defense. And while you should do everything you can to avoid killing civilians, if you have no choice but to kill civilians, you've got to fight back. Because if you don't fight back, what does that do? It encourages aggressive nations to put their missiles in civilian sites, which is completely against international law. And yet the world community isn't condemning Hamas for their missiles, isn't condemning Hamas for all the damage they do to Palestinian citizens. I want to know why Arabs are not rising up and condemning Hamas. They are doing so in secret, in quiet ways. I read in the newspaper that there are some groups that whisper among themselves, this isn't smart for Hamas to send missiles into Israel. That if you believe in the righteousness of the Palestinian Arab cause, the worst thing to do is to keep shooting these missiles. But you see, it becomes a macho thing. It becomes individuals who so want to win that they forget what they're fighting for. If they wanted a state, they could have one. Israel offered a state at Camp David with 95, 96, 97% of the entire West Bank, Gaza, and contiguous territory. Arafat, the Palestinian leadership, said no. So if they don't want a state, what do they want? I think what it is that when people are in pain, they lash out and they try to kill and they don't even worry about what they want. So what can the world do? What can the world do to try to encourage people to do the right thing? I'm asked if the presence of American warships will ignite a war in the area. And that's a good question, too. Actually, American warships are off the coast of Lebanon. Lebanon is on the northern border of Israel. Lebanon is in its own throes right now of civil war, largely because of Hezbollah. The Iranian government funds Hezbollah, and they fund it because they want to control the region as well. One of the sad ironies of our war in Iraq is we actually helped our enemy, Iran, become more powerful by weakening one of Iran's natural enemies, Saddam Hussein. So Iran is trying to take over Lebanon, and it in Syria, which had troops in Lebanon for decades, is trying to take over. Many Lebanese are fighting back, and Lebanon doesn't even have a president. They have their own civil war. I actually think American warships in the region, as long as we don't shoot, are good things. It's a sign of force. It's a sign showing that we could shoot if we had to. One of the warships in the region, interestingly enough, is the USS Cole. You may remember, this is the very ship that terrorists in Yemen bombed when we were in port in 2000. And I think it's good for America to show its presence. But I also think we have to be careful what we're fighting for. Fighting for the right of self-defense, not fighting for any particular faction one way or the other. One of the other questions I've asked about here, and I want to thank the caller for raising so many good questions, is the possibility of driving Hamas to Egypt. I think it's a broader issue as to what happens with Egypt. Egypt is a very interesting country. What would happen if Israel could convince Egypt, or the world could convince Egypt, to take back Gaza? Now, this may seem inconsistent. I've just argued that Egypt shouldn't have taken Gaza in the first place. Egypt, of course, took Gaza when it was supposed to be a Palestinian Arab state back in 1949 and occupied it and put the Palestinians in refugee camps and were kind of harsh for 18 years. But from the perspective of the Palestinian Arab who's living there, they don't have many good choices. What are their choices? Their choices are live under Hamas, where they can't get much fuel or food, just the basic humanitarian stuff that Israel lets through, where Israel fights back and shoots missiles into their yards because Hamas is putting missiles in their yards. That's not good. In fact, Gaza is worse off now than it's probably ever before been in its history. Another issue is living under Israeli occupation. Well, that's not pleasant. They don't want to be ruled by Jews. They want to rule themselves. The other possibility, yes, is living under Egyptian occupation. Arabs controlling Arabs. Now, yes, Egypt is a dictatorship, and a pretty nasty one at that. But then at least the people of Gaza would be no worse off than the people of Cairo or Alexandria or anywhere else in Egypt. They'd be living under an Arab government, and frankly, they'd be no worse off than any other Arab living under a dictatorship. Or maybe the answer is somehow bringing back democracy to Gaza. We'll explore that after this.
One day, I forgot to throw away my trash after lunch, but then I saw it later when I was playing in the woods. The next week, I went boating with my grandpa, and there it was. I tried to go swimming, but I couldn't because of my trash. And when I went fishing, well, you can guess what I caught that day. So now I always throw away my trash in the garbage can, where it belongs.
One in eight Americans goes hungry. One idea helped change that. A community started a garden that blossomed into farmers markets. One in six children lives in poverty. One group of women found an answer by opening a daycare center that their neighbors could afford. Today, 36 million Americans live in poverty. But one by one, people are helping themselves and each other to change the picture of poverty to one of hope. For easy ways you can help, visit PovertyUSA.org.
Every year, 250,000 Americans are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
My fellow scientists and I are working on treatments and a cure for this deadly disease.
Millions of lives are at stake. Alzheimer's disease affects one in three families.
We're committed to uncovering the mystery of Alzheimer's.
And we're not going to quit until the job is done.
To find out more about Alzheimer's disease, call 1-800-437-2423.
Only through research will a cure be found.
James, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Not a helmet. Your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important piece of equipment. I also wear another helmet that's just as important. A bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm talking about the situation in Israel and Gaza. There's still time for you to call in if you want to, agree or disagree. It's easy to do. Pick up the phone, dial 571-749-1166. If you're listening on the web, it's toll-free, 888-488-MARK. The Israeli government invaded Gaza on Saturday. They stayed on Sunday, and today they left. It was a limited operation. In doing so, they killed, according to them, 90 different terrorists. According to Hamas, they only killed 50 terrorists. But whether you look at the Israeli numbers or the Hamas numbers, and I frankly am more likely to believe the Israeli numbers, a number of them were killed. And some civilians were helping in the process. Israel describes a satellite picture they have of a man with a donkey cart who rolled up in a wheelbarrow, and covered up was not the smaller Qassam missiles, the ones that hit Sderot, the town I compared to Laredo, Texas, but the larger Grad missiles, the missiles that came from Iran, the missiles that hit the larger Israeli city of Ashkelon, the one I compared to San Diego. And there's an elderly man, and he's, 65, 70 years old, and he is bringing it in his donkey cart. So this man is as much a terrorist as the people who are shooting the missiles. So what is the answer here? A senior Israeli official described the situation bluntly. I have the quote on my website. He said, "This very limited Gaza operation was intended to show Hamas what could happen, what you may call a prequel," the senior Israeli official said. "If they decide they've seen enough and stop the rockets, if they get the message, then we may get into a period of quiet. If they continue to fire the rockets, then there will be more operations like this one or worse." So here it is. Here's the prequel. Do you think Hamas will stop? I don't. I don't think most people in the region think they will. Because again, Hamas is not out to help the Palestinian Arab people any more than the Arab countries are. Hamas wants them to be miserable. The Arab countries want them to be miserable. They want them to be miserable because they want them to fight against Israel. And if they're happy, if they are taken in as refugees, if they're allowed to become citizens, then they won't continue the war. So it doesn't help them. So what can they do? I think what they need to do is, and they may have to do it in secret, is work to support the existing Fatah groups that are already there. Now, admittedly, this is very dangerous. If you are Fatah, which is the group led by Mahmoud Abbas, and you live in Gaza, you're subject to arrest, you're subject to prison, you're subject to torture. It's a very dangerous thing. But if the Palestinians themselves can overthrow the Hamas government, then I think there may be a chance. And actually, I think that Israel and Mahmoud Abbas could work together to make that happen. Abbas does not have the power to overthrow Hamas, but Israel does. Israel, I think, needs to reoccupy Gaza. Not because it wants Gaza, not because it wants some greater Israel. There should be no settlements there. But reoccupy Gaza in order to help Mahmoud Abbas exert control. I think now that the 44% that voted for Hamas, and in the election, 44% voted for Hamas, 42% voted for the Palestinian Authority. So it was a very, very close election. I think those 44% regret their move because they see that they have no more jobs. They have no more food, not much food on the shelves, just basic humanitarian goods that Israel lets in. They don't have fuel anymore. They're spending all their money. Life is miserable in Gaza. Let's face it. It's terrible. There's no question about it. So maybe they'd be ready to be ruled, not by Israel, but by their own people. And my hope, frankly, is that a third party develops. Because I know that Abbas and the Palestinian Authority is corrupt. I know that. They at least are not trying to kill Israelis most of the time, but they are corrupt. There should be a third way, a third party. One of the things that I was really impressed recently with was the election in Pakistan, where you had a strong majority of Pakistanis stand up against their dictator, Musharraf, stand up against Islamic theocracy, and at the same time support a democracy. And I don't see any reason why that can't happen if the world supports it. But when the world says Israel don't fight back, when the world says Israel don't do self-defense, when the world says Israel don't reoccupy Gaza, what would they have Israel do? Would France not respond if Paris were being hit, or even Marseille? Would the United States sit there if missiles were going into Laredo or San Diego? Would we sit still? I would suggest to you that no country would sit still. Certainly none of these European countries. Now, can Israel drive Hamas to Egypt? One of the questions that I've been asked here by my very well-informed caller. That's tough, because many of them are natural to the area. And listen, Egypt won't take them. Egypt doesn't want them either. Israel, I think, has to work with either Mahmoud Abbas or Egypt or both. Heck, they could divide it if they wanted. And put either Egyptian control or Abbas control over Gaza. And hopefully encourage the people to say, look, you can vote for any government you want. If you don't want corrupt Hezbollah, you can vote for Hamas. You can have a complete democracy with one condition, and only one condition. Stop trying to kill Israelis. It's not that difficult a condition. When you think about it, it's the kind of condition that we imposed on Nazi Germany. We said, we're going to occupy it. You can become a democracy. The only thing you can't do is take up arms against your neighbors. Now, given that Europe has gone through this very crisis, why are they opposed to Israel doing the same thing? To reoccupying the land, putting in, saying, you can vote for however you want, just stop killing us. I've said before, the real secret is nonviolence. The last question I was asked is about the Iranian president and his visit to Iraq. The Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is a very interesting character. Mostly because he's not in control. Sometimes he reminds me of Ann Coulter because he spouts off a lot, but he's not really in charge. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is a figurehead. In fact, the election in Iran turns out to be a fair election, but the theocratic rulers only allowed two people to run, him and Rafsanjani. Again, Rafsanjani was corrupt, so the people voted for the unknown, which was Ahmadinejad. Now, he's a nut. He's a dangerous nut, but he's not in charge. The real power is Khatami. And I think that we can work around Ahmadinejad. I think the best thing to do for that man is to ignore him. I firmly agree with Senator Obama's idea of negotiating with the government of Iran. But I'll tell you where I disagree with Senator Obama. Instead of negotiating with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Obama should ask to negotiate with the leader, Khamenei, the Ayatollah, the real one in charge of Iran. Because Ahmadinejad is just a figurehead, and he likes getting a lot of attention. And he should meet with him in secret. It could be face-to-face, it could be via phone call. Doesn't matter. I agree with Obama that you should negotiate with our enemies. But instead of negotiating with the figurehead that they put out there, let's negotiate with the real people in power. And I think that's a fair way to take Obama's vision to negotiate with our enemies, but make sure it doesn't become a propaganda victory for someone like the Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who has denied the Holocaust and argued that Israel should be wiped off the map and things like that. Look, all three presidential candidates, Obama, Clinton, and McCain, all agree that Iran should not have nuclear weapons and that Iran should not allow to become the threat that it is. And I should say this. I have met many, many Iranian citizens, ex-Iranians, Iranian-Americans, and most of them are very good people. Most of them do not respect their government. Most of the Iranians in Iran don't like their government. Again, it's a dictatorship. The interesting thing is that when the Iranians elected a freely elected leader who was relatively moderate, frankly, Khatami, we did nothing. The Bush administration did nothing. Here was our chance to take the elected leader and to promote him over the Ayatollahs in charge, and we didn't negotiate when we could have. We've really missed a chance. And now we have Iran and Iraq. Iraq controlled by a Shiite government, and Iran is trying to extend its hegemony over the entire region. And the scary, stupid thing is, if we hadn't gone into Iraq in the first place, Iraq and Iran were relatively balanced. We have only made Iran stronger. So I think we have to, in order to fight against Ahmadinejad, we have to encourage democracy throughout the region, but peaceful democracy. I think we can have one position for all peoples in the region, and that position is really very simple. No intentional attacks on your neighbor, unless it's in self-defense. No intentional attacks on civilians, and we should promote democracy. But the kind of democracy where people are not hurting other people. It's really not that hard. It goes back to the golden rule, I guess. I think the great majority of Muslims and Christians and Jews all over the world are not out to kill each other. I know there are disagreements. There was and is a negotiation between Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Mahmoud Abbas. There are definitely Israelis that oppose peace talks as well. There are Israelis that want a much larger Israeli state. Here's the trick. Here's the trick to harm those that want greater Israel. There's an easy way to abolish their concerns. All the Palestinians have to try is nonviolence. Hamas helps those on the far right of Israel that want to keep all the land for decades and decades, because Hamas is ensuring there will be war for decades and decades. But all it takes is one Palestinian leader to be like a certain Jewish carpenter 2,000 years ago, to come up and to talk about nonviolence and to say we have differences, we need to discuss them, but we need to stop killing each other. Golda Meir once said, "The only time we'll have peace is when the Arabs love their children more than they hate ours." Right now, the Arab leadership is not doing any good for the people in the Palestinian territories. Hamas is not doing any good for them there. The world needs to condemn Hamas. And if Israel has to reoccupy Gaza, they need to support that. Not just for Israel, but for the Arabs there as well. Hope you've enjoyed tonight's show. If you want to know more information about the Inside Scoop, check out RadioInsideScoop.com. This is Mark Levine, signing off.